Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
So, extraordinary scenes over in Buenos Aires, Kenny Cunningham. Local rivals Boca Juniors, River Plate playing in the Copa Libertadores, the South American Champions League final. And it's now not even going to be on in Argentina. They've ruined it for everyone, is the short version. So it's going to happen either December 8th or 9th. It was meant to happen on Saturday. It was delayed twice. Then it was postponed until Sunday. And then it was called off. The River Plate fans attacked the Boca team coach, Marcelo Moura Iorahu, will join us later on the football show and fill us all in. Boca are formally asking for River Plate to be disqualified. They don't even want to play the match whatsoever. They're saying this thing shouldn't go ahead. And there's
not
much soul, much soul searching in Argentinian football as their worst stereotypes, football fan stereotypes, are kicking in. And it doesn't, the reports are saying, do their joint bid for a 2030 World Cup.
Ah, yeah.
Much good either. Mm. Yeah, I think Boca asking for a disqualification would be a hollow victory, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I always feel that, you know, the game should be decided on the pitch. I take the point. Maybe they might have to take it outside Buenos Aires. Interesting talk to take one of the Spanish league games over to the States this year, wasn't there?
Yeah.
It'd be interesting if they were to make a decision to take that game to the United States. Would it? I mean, obviously, even if you took it to the States, there'd be big support for both those teams, even within the States,
yeah,
in terms of kind of, you know,
immigrant population, yeah.
You'd wonder, would that fanatical element, would that still be evident, even the game in the States amongst the supporters? Mm. Or whether that kind of reaction to the supporters is just limited to the supporters inside the city, inside Buenos Aires?
It's a hell of a question, Kendi. You can ask Marcella yourself. She's the expert in this, not me. Don't be hitting me with those questions, but it's an interesting one. As of yet, there's no confirmation as to where they're going to play it. I would presume they're frantically ringing around, and most FAs are saying, don't think so. You're all right.
Yeah.
I think we'll pass on that one, but cheers for the offer.
I'd be ashamed the obvious thing is to play it behind closed doors, but funny enough, we had this conversation a couple of weeks ago in the studio. You weren't here, Joe, where Johnny Ward was here.
Yeah.
We were talking about...
The great Johnny Ward.
The one and only. This conversation was great, sporting events around the globe. If you had an opportunity to go and travel, and that was the one that sprung to mind in terms of a derby game in football, I thought, well, yeah, River Plate at Buenos Aires in terms of the energy inside the stadium would be absolutely amazing. But, you know, nobody would have wanted to in the vicinity of that stadium.
Well, I don't know, did you see on Thursday, Boca were having their final training session and there were 60,000 fans in the stadium for it. It was doing the rounds on Twitter. It was ridiculous. It was really extraordinary scenes. So they take their football seriously over there, that's for sure. So we'll talk to Marcelo Moura Iorahu just after 9:30 or so. Keeping an eye on the Champions League football, they're back underway at Old Trafford, 5 minutes into the second half, and nil all between Manchester United and Young Boys. It seems young Marcus Rashford, Kenny's missed a good chance, and Jose made a gesture as if to say, you see what I'm working with? What more can I do?
You haven't seen it myself.
We haven't seen it yet, yeah, but we're working off what people are saying about it. But it was, you can imagine it.
Oh, it's poor. I just don't understand it. I really don't understand it.
The other news is that Damien Duff has confirmed he's in talks with Celtic. I spoke to them last week. He was telling the viewers in RTE this evening. Went over to training ground, met everybody. It was so impressive for me and for most Irishmen. They're one of the biggest clubs in the world. There is a role going with the reserves. We're still talking to them. I'm obsessed with learning and improving. Could be an amazing environment to do so.
Yeah.
What route am I going to go down after finishing football? It's all I know. I don't have a school education, so I can't go down that route. I'm absolutely obsessed with football, obsessed with learning and improving. He said he'd swim over to work there, but he's got a wife and two young kids, so he said the decision isn't entirely straightforward. And then he said, and this may be just the most duffer finish ever, when there's kids involved, it's obviously hard and an emotional thing to do. Maybe I'll have to bribe them and get them a dog. I'm afraid of dogs, so I'll obviously have to rent two houses over there.
I think it's a great story.
Yeah.
Wonderful opportunity. It's great to hear, actually, you know, former teammates and colleagues, you know, forge another career on the coaching side. Mm. Obviously, he's really enjoyed his experiences at Shamrock Rovers, but I think this is the right time for him to make that step up into a different environment, probably a more challenging environment. That's not disrespect, obviously, where he is at the moment at Shamrock Rovers. So I think it's a natural progression for Damon. It sounds like a great opportunity.
Did he strike you as a coach? I'm going to ask you the same question about Robbie Keane, I suppose.
I don't. He loved his football. Loved it. Both of them did. But there's a natural transition there onto a coaching capacity. Some people love the training ground. You know, being on the training pitch, the interaction with the players, working players in 1v1 situation, player improvement, that type of thing. The real kind of nuts and bolts of coaching. So it's kind of to a certain extent, what your skill set is. Some are very good in the dressing room with players on a personal level, very kind of personable. So all of those things come into it in terms of what defines a great coach for me. It's a number of different things. People talk about great man managers, but for me to be a great coach, you need to be a great communicator as well. You need to know how to manage players. You need to understand players. You need to develop a good rapport with your players for me to be a really good coach, to get the very best, to draw the very best out of them. And again, there needs to be a healthy respect there. So, no, it doesn't totally surprise me that Duffers has gone down this road. And again, it's great to see. And they're not the only ones. You know, we talk about developing young players, talent within the country, young Irish football players. But we should think along the same lines in terms of our young coaches as well. So it's great to see over the last couple of years. And I've tried to keep in contact with a number of the players, not to a great extent, but, you know, text here and there, phone call occasionally.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd point to Mark Kennedy, you know, who's making good progress in a great environment. Talk about Duffer's gone to a great environment at Celtic. Mark Kennedy's in that environment in the academy. At Manchester City, Lee Cards, we know, was in the setup at the FA in England. And there's a number of those stories. Stephen Reid, Curtis Fleming's up in Middlesbrough as well.
Yeah.
You know, there's a sprinkling of players who've dipped their toe in terms of in the international setup here, the underage age groups, a little bit hands off, not full on in terms of having their own teams, but have had a taste of it. So that's all good.
Who in the Irish camp did strike you as somebody who would be a good coach? Because it turns out it's very hard to predict. You know, it's often other players don't predict they're going to do it or go on to do it. Nobody saw Mark Hughes, for instance, it seems, at Manchester United going into coaching. Was there anyone that you played with for Ireland that you thought he'll definitely go on to coaching and will be good at it? And maybe surprised you by not doing it. But was there any at the time you thought, nailed on coach here?
Within the team that I played
yeah.
for? I don't think there probably would have been one standout player. The players who I've mentioned already haven't surprised me.
Okay.
The one which probably has surprised me a little bit, there's always one, and he won't mind me mentioning him, I mentioned him already, is Mark Kennedy. Because Mark would have been a wonderfully talented player. I played with Mark.
Yeah.
But Mark's attitude would have been, he probably would admit this himself as a player, look, when I finish this game, you're not going to see me. I'm gone.
Yeah.
I'm just going to disappear. I'm going to put as much distance between myself and football as I possibly can. I think Mitch quote was saying about Mark, you know, poacher turned
gamekeeper. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly, like, you know what I mean? But he loves it. I've spoken to Mark since
right.
When he was working up at Ipswich. Absolutely loves it. You know, same type of attitude with Duffers, you know, wanting to learn, wanting to develop,
yeah.
wanting to get better. Loves to work loves being on the training pitch with the players, working with the players, looking to improve them individually. That's great to see.
Yeah. I was reading, there's an anthology out of Sunday Independent articles from the last 30 years, and one of them is a Paul Kimmich piece, The Team That Mick Built.
Yeah.
And he's spoken to various different players around the time of the qualification for the World Cup in 2002. And actually, it's McAteer talking about Lee Carsley. And he was talking about just how disciplined Lee Carsley was. So he would be, you know, first thing up in the morning, he'd be showered and in his shoes by 8:05 every morning, no matter what. He'd be in from training straight away, in the shower, ready to go. Everything tidy, everything neat, everything done properly. Shoes polished, boots polished for the next day. He was saying Carsley was like a member of the military. That was his approach to things.
Military style, yeah.
Military style Lee Carsley, yeah. Just a really disciplined fella.
But that would have been a number of the players.
I'm sure,
Joe.
Yeah, I'm sure.
The lads, we enjoyed ourselves, don't get me wrong.
Well, McAteer was saying McAteer had been from training and flopping the bed in his muddy shorts and like maybe get into the shower within about 2 hours if he was lucky, get down for dinner just about. You know, just that kind of an attitude, whereas Carsley.
Yeah, I understand, and that's what makes it so special, different kind of personality, different personalities, right? But generally speaking, the lads as a group, kind of very professional in how they look after themselves.
Right.
Duffers was the one as well, even from a very young age, very conscientious in terms of stretching exercises and his routine prior and post training, as were a number of players, time in the gym, you know, maintenance work which they needed to do with their kind of physical conditioning, all that type of thing. Generally speaking, the lads were spot on.
I have a text here on Robbie. So Robbie Keane, lads, just me, or have not many strikers made great managers? All I've got is Alex Ferguson and Brian Clough. Both exceptional, I grant you, says the texter. Kenny Dalglish won a league, I'll give you that as well. But after that, I'm running quickly out of names. It's just a thought. Yours faithfully, Dan.
Well, there's no reason why they can't be.
Interesting, though. Because I saw that text earlier and I was trying to think of strikers who've gone on to be great managers. You know, really won leagues or won European Cups.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking Klinsmann obviously went in Germany that time for like...
I'm giving Klinsmann a meh. I'm giving him a meh.
Yeah, yeah. But then no reason why they shouldn't. Again, managers for me, different personality traits. I've played under managers, very good coaches. Love being on the training pitch. Mick, as a young manager, was very active on the training pitch. Other managers not overly concerned. But maybe don't have this the skill set. Well, actually, skill set, and actually, will delegate that responsibility to other people.
Yeah.
And that's a trait of management. You know.
Do you ever think delegation? That maybe strikers are playing a little bit off the cuff? They're not too worried about what's going on further back the pitch. They're just about movement, and maybe they don't see the game as well as potentially a midfielder or a centre half. Or is that nonsense? Because the texture does
that's
Alex Ferguson and Brian Clough, so you know they're pretty good.
Yeah, that's too much of a generalisation.
General
I played with players, centre forwards, like good understanding, very good understanding of the game. Yeah, got good pictures, clear pictures in the head in terms of how.
Give me your third striker who's a great manager. After Clough and Ferguson.
Strikers. So I'm thinking the managers in the at the moment. It's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's quite striking. No pun intended.
But I think it's great. I'm delighted for Robbie. I see. In terms of learning curve for him, talking about Duffers going into Celtic, that's great for Robbie. Mm. Working under Mick, obviously, Terry Connor in that kind of environment, that can only help Robbie as well going forward. Interesting to see exactly his role there. I expect Robbie to be, you know, sitting down. The strikers that we have, young strikers coming into the international fold. You know, no better man, Robbie, to be sitting down with them 1v1 situations, maybe a bit of video analysis of their particular games in terms of their movements on the pitch, where they need to be in around the box. You know, lending information to the players, passing on his experience, maybe working with the players on those forwards on the training pitch, you know, little drills, that type of thing as well. You know, as well as his kind of personality, how he carries himself around the place as well. So, yeah, it's great to see Robbie involved.
Yeah, and he approached Mick first, as Mick said on Sunday, and he said, yeah, why not, the more I thought about it. So we spoke briefly earlier on, and you said you're very excited about the next 18 months, 2 years under Mick. You're back enthused about where things
are going
to go. And beyond.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And the process beyond that, as has been set down, as I understand, that Stephen's going to come in after that period. Stephen is fascinating as well, really interesting listening to his conversation with the journalist, different personality obviously to Mick, but I like what he had to say. Mm. Very interesting. And I think there's an argument there in terms of, I heard someone say, well, why doesn't he just be better off from to stay at Dundalk for 2 years and then take, or why is he coming in and taking a 21 job?
Yeah.
But Joe, for me, there's a strong argument. Stephen Kenny is going to be better prepared stepping in as our senior international manager in 18 months or 2 years after this stint, this role he's in at the moment. Because what Stephen hasn't had is an extended period of time in the international setup. And there are slight deviations, a slight difference in terms of team preparation is an obvious one, in terms of how you prepare your club team week in, week out, which he's been very good at Dundalk. He's been better at that. He's been absolutely exceptional in terms of the body work that he's done up at Dundalk. But at the moment, it's such a well-oiled machine up there. He's just basically repeating the processes year in, year out. And that's how good that he is. He doesn't have to do anything else.
Yeah.
The international setup is different. You get the players together 4 or 5 days before the game. It's a different kind of environment. It's just a different beat. What are you going to prioritise in terms of your work during that week from a tactical point of view, the physical condition?
He has said he's going to use some of the time to go and visit other national coaches.
But that's what I'm saying. He'll have the time to do that.
No, I appreciate that.
So this is the advantage of this particular role. He'll have the hands-on experience of working with the under 21s at a good level, and he'll experience exact same teams that I'm talking about in terms of getting the players together in an intense period of time, working with the players, what to prioritise, the intensity of the sessions, even in terms of downtime.
Yeah, okay.
I'll give you those things. And we haven't even spoken about in terms of his tentacles reaching, in terms of below that, in terms of the underage setup as well, in terms of working with the coaches underneath, that kind of joined up thinking, which a lot of people have spoken about over a long period of time, in terms of that detachment between the senior squad, 21s and below. It needs to be more kind of joined up thinking. The communication lines seem to be better.
What's Rude Doctor's job been then?
Well, he's part.
So if Rude Doctor thinks X and Stephen Kenny thinks Y, what happens?
Well, I don't think that is the case, because I think Stephen's gone on record as saying he's had conversations, footballing conversations with Ruud, and in terms of how the model, how they see in terms of how the underage players, the fundamentals of how they want them to play, they're very much preaching from the same hymn book.
And there's talk that Mick will almost be a mentor to him, and maybe he will in some respects, and they'll sit down for a coffee. But Stephen Kenny will be managing the under-21s around the international windows, and I doubt he wants to be seen to be almost running around.
He doesn't have to be.
After Mick all the time in front of the other players.
He doesn't have to be.
I don't think they'll be too involved with each other, I would think.
No, I don't think so. I think there will be those kind of conversations between them. They will sit down, there will be discussions. I'm sure Stephen will lean on Mick to a certain extent. But Stephen's a very experienced manager. He's got a huge amount of games under his belt, obviously within the domestic league over here, and also in Europe. How many games has Stephen been involved in kind of Europa Champions League? Over 40 to 50 games. You know what I mean? He's got a huge amount of experience.
To be honest, I think everybody thinks Stephen Kenny deserves a crack at this, actually. I don't think there's any issues with that.
Well, that's what I'm saying, because when I saw that list of those listening, I saw a list of 16, 20 Sven Garnaut and high profile managers, but straight away Mick and Stephen Kenny for me were the two that jumped out. And a lot of people, I don't think you probably know better than me, those two names in particular, I would have thought there's a huge groundswell of support behind those two players. If either one of them be given, say, a four-year contract, a majority of people would have been happy, I think, for different kind of reasons. Mick, in terms of his stature, kind of personality, experience that he has. Stephen, in terms of his body of work, probably in some respects a different type of appointment, but someone who's very bright, who's looking to learn, who wants to improve, has his own strong personality as well, that type of thing. So to actually put a system down where it actually incorporates both of these players, where both these men are going to have the opportunity to lead the national team, I have absolutely no problem.
Do you have an issue with the August 2020 in writing, immovable, locked into that in a sport where things change so quickly?
No. Well, things do change. So and in football, we've seen everything.
I find that surprising. Why would you lock yourself into that?
But why not? I put more stock in terms of what the managers have said. When I listened to Mick speak at that interview, he's saying to somebody who Mick's a strong personality. If Mick wasn't happy with the details of that contract, the length of that contract, he wouldn't have signed it. Mick's a strong enough character.
But I mean, he admitted he wanted two terms, but he wasn't an offer, so I had no choice, so I took it. He wants the Ireland job no matter what. I don't think he thinks it's ideal. I don't think if you talk to him privately,
I've said this already.
Championships, he's not going to want to give
that
up.
If Mick had gone into that, if Mick had walked into that initially, in his mindset, he probably would have thought two qualifications, three or four-year contract. Yeah. That's what he would have wanted. Mm. Stephen Kenny, would he have taken the job now, or in 2 years' time, he'd want the job now?
Yeah.
That's clearly the case. But I think for me, this is perfect. Because I think at the moment where we are in terms of the team, I think that's a low ebb there, confidence at a real low ebb. And I think Mick McCarthy, for the reasons that I've said, the attributes that he has with his experience, he's the one to turn things around very quickly and get us looking up. And I think in the intervening period, the next 18 to 24 months, Stephen Kenny will be absolutely meticulous in terms of how he prepares himself for the next challenge in his career as an international manager. And this is a man who's starting at a high bar anyway, in terms of the qualities which he had. You talk to players, I put a huge amount of stock, Joe. I haven't spoken to every player who's played under. I know Mick, I played under them. I've already spoken about his attributes other players have. I remember speaking to players at Derry City. I coached one of the league select teams here a couple of years ago, a couple of games in the Aviva, and there was a body of players from Derry City. Stephen was manager at the time. I was always interested in speaking to the players, a range of different things. Spoke with the manager, how do you find Stephen? Straight away, they liked him.
Great, yeah. That's not really the point I'm making. It's not a point against Stephen, and it's not a point for or against Mick. The point is actually about the FAI and the decision to lock into this arrangement when there was no need to lock into it. I mean, would you not rather make your decision in 18 months when you have all the facts?
Yeah, but I have no problem with it for the reasons that I've said. And I don't understand. If you're saying to me you've got a huge amount of respect for Stephen Kenny, you think he's a talented manager, and likewise Mitch McCarthy, different kind of personality, but still highly talented, I don't see how you can make...
For two reasons, right?
A strong argument against it.
So either way, so let's say things go very, very well.
Yeah.
Things go really well, and there's a great chemistry, and Mick's getting the best out of the team.
Yeah.
You risk upsetting that. Stephen Kenny may be a brilliant manager, may prove to be a brilliant manager, but actually, you've got something potentially in 2 years' time which you know is working. It's hard to get things that work. Chemistry is difficult, which you know is working, And there may be a general feeling in 18 months, gosh, there'd be such momentum going into World Cup where you know this management team and this group of players are working well, and we've spoken to the players off the record, they really want him to stay. So that's scenario one, and that could be then difficult to tear that apart and put in a new manager. Okay, so that's one.
I don't think so. Not when it's already in place, Stephen.
Or if things don't go well for Mick, 3, 4, 5 games into the qualifying, then people are going to say, well, look, he's not even staying around for very long. Let's just get him out now and let's get Stephen Kenny in as soon as possible.
I think you're wrong. I don't think that's
I guarantee you that talk will happen if things don't go well under
Mick. I don't think it will. I think it's only a 10-month process between the first qualification.
That's what people will say. People will say, well, just get him out. I mean, what's the point? Get Kenny in early.
No, I don't think so. I think people will stick with Mick and give him a little bit of time. We're struggling at the moment. We're at a low ebb at the moment.
People have patience with Mick and give him a little bit of time. No, I know, but what would be the point in giving Mick time? To what end? Because you're getting rid of him in 6 months anyway. I'd say they'll say get Stephen Kenny in, give him a chance to prepare for the World Cup.
Stephen, we'll have time with Eskay. If we go, Stephen will have enough time regardless for me. Mick will get a qualifying campaign. He's got a contract. That's a given. I know you're throwing a different kind of scenarios at me. I just don't think they're realistic. I don't see them. Nobody can predict the future. But the best case scenario for me, and you mentioned it earlier, is in terms we get a big upturn in terms of quality performances under Mick during the qualifying campaign, and hopefully that will end up in qualification for the championships.
I suppose.
And then Mick hands the baton over. It's agreed. It's in place. There's not going to be a rebellion. It's not going to be a rebellion amongst the players. The players aren't going to down tools. And to be fair. Mick's attitude in this might well be, and I said it before, I think Mick's got aspirations going forward to go back into club management and manage at the highest level possible. Mm. And Mick might very well say that the best case scenario for him is leaving the Irish job on a high, having qualified for the major championship, and then bouncing into a high-profile job back in England.
But again, none of that changes. That may all be possible.
Continue.
Yes, but wouldn't it be lovely to be able to make that decision with all the facts in 18 months' time? And the issue I have here is, it's the motivation behind this decision that I'm suspicious of. Okay, it's the reasoning for
I'm not getting caught up in that. I'm not overly interested.
Right, fine.
In that.
Well, I think it's a key point for Irish football, actually, because the reason these decisions are being made has to be for the right reasons. And I think last week, there were big issues facing the FAI and the board. And I think this decision, you talked about the popularity of Kenny and the popularity of Mick. What better way to get everybody sort of on board with this than to magic up this solution? And so people have talked about it as great planning.
Yeah,
I think it was on the hoof, almost opportunism. How can we settle everything down?
I don't know. That may be the case, but we've ended up in the right place for me with the right people in charge going forward over the next 6 years.
And your point is it could work.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. No, look, I accept that too. It could absolutely work. We usually play a clip from Virgin Sport of a Champions League evening. So Brian Kerr is on, interestingly, talking about all this. He's given his reaction to the appointment of Mick and Stephen Kenny as successive managers. And here we'll have a listen to what Brian Kerr makes of it. Haven't heard what he's had to say about it.
Brian Knowles says he'd been surprised that Mick accepted these circumstances, the almost glass ceiling. What's your view?
I think it's a kind of a bizarre arrangement. I've never come across the likes of it in football before. We something going on in rugby, but that was much different, much more obvious thing, because the discussions about whether Joe Smith was going to stay or not have been going on for a long time. This situation, it almost looks like as if the FAI are saying, Mick, we think you're the right man for the job for a while, but we're not giving it to you for any longer than 2 years. You're no good after 2 years. You're out. But we know a bloke that we think will be good in 2 years' time if we tell him he's getting it now and we give him a bit of practice at another level. That's not quite the same as a good bit different from what he's been doing before, but we're kind of sure that he's the right man in a while's time, in 2 years down the road. It's a most bizarre arrangement. I'm happy for both of them. I know Stephen very well since he was a young lad and I signed him for St. Pat's. I'm delighted with his progress. I actually predicted the day would come when he'd be the Ireland manager in an article for the Irish Independent 2 years ago. And I'm surprised it's come as quickly that they've made this arrangement. But for both of them, they've got to be very happy. And it could work out very well, although I do think it's a bizarre way it's fallen. Mick was here with us last Monday and Tuesday. I remember joking with him on Monday and saying, the way this is going for Martin, he could be in here with us in a few weeks' time, and the three ex-managers could be sitting together. But I knew he was up there as one of the favourites for it, but I didn't think it was going to be happening that quickly. And we had a good laugh about that on Monday night, yeah. And he was here on Tuesday too.
So that was Kerr on Virgin Media Sport, which is the new home of European football in Ireland. More than 400 Champions League, Europa League, Nations League games live this season. Virgin Media Sport, exclusive to all Virgin Media TV customers. And you can also download the TV Anywhere app and stream all the action whenever and wherever they like. So to sum up where we are, I am still slightly curious about the motivation for the decision, and I don't like it. I'm suspicious of it. Whereas you're saying, well, build a bridge and get over that.
Yeah.
We are where we are, and you think it could still work, even if the rationale behind the decision making yeah. was a bit suspicious.
Well, Brian pretty much said the same at the moment. We've got a lot of time for yeah. Brian. I agree with a lot of what he says, but at the end of it, it was interesting. At the end, he said it is unusual. I'm not saying it's not unusual. We've seen people from an existing management structure step up to be the next manager. We've seen an under 21 manager step up and be the next international man, but not quite this scenario. So it is unusual in that respect.
It's the locked in
part. Yeah, but it can work. And Brian alluded to it there. It's something which can work. When you've got people, for me, with the skill sets
yeah.
and as talented as these two, there's a strong argument there for saying that it will work. As long as both people, and Mick in particular, in terms is genuine, his commitment to the agreement as it is. And I just take Mick at his word.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. When he comes out publicly and says, yes, I've signed the agreement, I'm happy with it, I'll be stepping down regardless of the how successful that we are. And Mick will be working like a demon behind the scenes to walk away from this position with...
The team doing well and everything
the team
good.
Having
no doubt of any of that.
And leaving the team in a better position than when he first stepped in. We all want the same thing. Mick, Steve, us in this room, all the supporters, we want to see an upturn, we want to see an improvement mm-hmm. and us play to the best of our ability. And back a little bit to that kind of a bit of a Cavaliers style of play, kind of high energy game that we've seen in previous Ireland teams. I think we're capable of that, and hopefully Mick and ultimately Steve, when he steps in, will tap into that.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll just have to see how it plays out. I certainly hope we're not in a position in June, July 2020 where there is a groundswell saying leave Mick in, because I think that would be unfair on Kenny, but I think it's entirely possible. And the FAI have created this deadline, and I don't think they should have, but we'll...
Let's park it. Are we going to park it?
Disagree.
We'll park it?
We'll pick it up in June 2020. okay, some texts in. Manchester United, sorry, I should have updated you. We just got sucked into that conversation. Still nil all at Old Trafford. 75 minutes on the clock. Lukaku came on about 10 minutes ago, I saw. But no breakthrough yet for Manchester United against Young Boys, so I don't think the reaction will be great in Old Trafford if it stays like that. Meanwhile, Manchester City are 1-1 with Lyon over in France. Typical. As soon as we switch over, we miss two goals. Lyon took the lead on 55 minutes, and Laporte has equalised for City, I presume from a corner, but who knows with them. On 62 minutes, the equaliser came for Manchester City, so 1-1 there. And Real Madrid have scored twice, so 75 minutes gone. Gareth Bale on 47 minutes for Madrid, and Lucas Vasquez on 59 minutes. So Madrid 2-0 up away to Roma, which means they'll top that group. And there was one other thing I wanted to do. Oh yeah, the text messages are coming in. Dave in City West. Van Gaal was a striker in Holland? ? No, I think Van Gaal was a very slow midfielder. Mark Hughes. Maybe not, says Noel. It's a bit harsh on Hughes. We'll throw him in.
No, he's managed at the top level yeah. for quite... Yeah, that's...
I mean, I'm wondering about great managers. Show. Marion Galway, Zidane. I'm having Zidane as a midfield playmaker, not a striker.
He's not a striker.
Toshak, Keegan, Dalglish. Was Keegan a great manager? Great, we're talking here, Kenny.
Top. Let's not go down that,
okay.
that route.
Jopenka's lads, great manager, Brendan. You'd have to say he's, yeah, okay. If you've won a European Cup. No, I'll give you that. That's chipping away at the texters theory. Goalkeepers make great popes, says Kieran and Ranelagh. Klopp. I thought Klopp was a centre half. Yeah, I don't think Klopp. Cruyff. I don't have him as a striker.
No.
I'm talking to Robbie Keane. Fox in the box, playing off the shoulder. Yeah.
Inzaghi, funny enough. Inzaghi, the ex-Italian
centre
forward. Yeah, he's managing in Italy the last number of years.
He's
the
classic
his brother
striker.
As well as managed.
And he's doing well? Well. He's doing top. Alan Shearer, says somebody. Not quite yet. Clivert. Clivert managing? Oh, he is. He was involved with the Dutch side. But look, he's not top yet. Hoddle was a good manager. Again, playmaker. Playmakers are, I mean, I have no issue with playmakers being great managers. Mm. They're seeing the game. They're seeing the picture.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about the Robbie Keane, Fox in the box. Yeah, Fox that's what we're talking about.
It's only a matter of time before you...
Yeah. Mancini's had some success. Matthew Quinn. Yeah. Just off the top of the head, lads, Jupp Heynckes was a striker. I'm sure there's several others.
Vialli.
And Brian adds in, also, saying apart from Ferguson and Brian Clough is quite the apart. To be fair, it is. Lads, apart from Alex Ferguson and Brian Clough, has there been any great managers? No, I accept that.
That has weakened.
Okay, so have we shot down the text in? Dan, not so sure that strikers are great managers. Marco van Basten, somebody else says, Jack in Tullamore. Not sure he's been great manager. But I think even the texter by mentioning Ferguson and Clough has probably shot himself in the foot there. I think that's killed that one. Any final thoughts then on Ireland? We've about covered it. You're excited. You're back enthused about this again. And bring it on is where you are.
Yeah, I really am.
Okay.
Really looking forward to next March.
If you're happy, I'm happy. We'll take a short break. 78 minutes in the clock. Still nil all at Old Trafford. We'll be going over to Marcela Mora Iorahu as well, Argentinian football writer, and hearing about events in Buenos Aires.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Now, you're welcome back. So, still no goals at Old Trafford, 82 minutes in the clock. Young Boys just made a substitution and Luke Shaw was not happy at the pace which the substitute was leading the pitch. So, went over and gave him a big push off the pitch. That's a level of the frustration at Old Trafford. And interestingly, Kenny, you can see it there. Lots of red seats suddenly visible, even though it's nil all on a Champions League evening and there's 8 minutes to go.
What's the ramifications, Joe? Do we know in terms of a draw here?
As things stand, Juve are 12 points, United are 8 points, and Valencia are 5 points. So United are still in an okay position, but they could have put it to bed this evening.
Barely an okay position, because the last game is going to be away to Valencia, knowing that a win for Valencia would put them out. That's as I understand it. Mm. The head-to-head of the two games will favour Valencia, if that's the case.
We can just double check that and we'll get confirmation of that for people. But in the meantime, let's speak with Marcela Mora Iorahu, a football journalist and writer. The second leg of the Copa Libertadores final, which was between Buenos Aires rivals Boca Juniors and River Plate, will now be played, it seems, if it's going to be played at all, outside Argentina on either December the 8th or 9th, the biggest game in certainly Argentinian club football history. Probably extraordinary scenes over the weekend. The second leg delayed twice on Saturday, then postponed until Sunday, and then eventually called off following an attack by River Plate fans on the Boca team coach. And now it seems Boca have officially asked for River Plate to be disqualified. Marcela, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
So, extraordinary scenes. Do you want to add on to any of the other bits and pieces that you've seen from the weekend or read about? I talked about the attack on the bus, but it was a fairly extraordinary couple of days all round.
It was a fairly extraordinary couple of days all round. I mean, I've been revisiting other Boca River games in my lifetime and reminiscing with fans, both Boca and River fans, remembering footage I've filmed. 20, 30 years ago, we did productions for French TV, for the BBC. Someone was replying to me today. They remembered going to a game where the River fans set toilet rolls on fire and threw them across the terraces. It's always been this incredible imagery. There's beautiful pictures on Twitter of the fireworks in gold and blue and red and white and the chanting and the kind of extraordinary mixture of fear and excitement that nothing else gives you. And I do think a little bit that is kind of what we were all hoping to see this weekend and what the world in particular was hoping to see. So the build-up, the hype to this has been absolutely massive. Now, I met today the fifth person that I know that's been going to these games for decades, who was trampled on, fell over, had their ticket stolen, ended up laying flat on the floor, got hit by police batons that seemed to be being flayed kind of randomly. A journalist who's written several books about supporting River over the years said he's never seen tear gas thrown so freely around. And I do think to a certain extent, we did all want to see something amazingly weird and crazy happen. And that it seems like the suspension of the game, the fact that there was no ball flying around doing the beauty of football, has kind of left this carcass of a monster without the game. It's absolutely hideous, and they're really horrible images. But equally, it might have been quite an anticlimax if it had just all gone smoothly and a normal football match had been played, because it's like we built it up to be something that it could never be. It was an impossible match. Now we've kind of spiraled into a typically Argentinian scenario, which we actually happened throughout the World Cup, of enormous speculation, a lot of kind of interests, the conflicting various politicians, football directors, fans, fan bases, groups, journalists, speculating as to what might happen. At one point today, I was going across the city, and a lot of TV screens have this kind of rolling footage of the problems. You know, the crowd throwing stones and the police from the weekend. It's like just a wallpaper in the city with news captions of what's happening. And there was a split banner that said, on the one hand, Boca refuses to play, and then just below it, the match might be played in Qatar. Boca's refusing to play, but if it is played, it could be early December or mid-December in Qatar or in Miami or in Paraguay. But Boca's not going to be playing it. So it's quite surreal, really. And there's a parallel kind of Argentine political dynamic running through this. The Ministry of Security of the city resigned yesterday, kind of acknowledging responsibility for the arrangements of the police going wrong. But the Minister of Security for the nation has said there's only one responsible here. There's only one blame to be allocated, and that's to the stone throwers, right, which is kind of slightly limited view, I think, of what unraveled, which is it's a situation that everywhere where football is played, and there's a lot of young men with not much else to do, these things tend to happen, and we've seen them in England and so on. But something very ugly happened here at the weekend, which also involves, as you correctly said, you know, that not knowing the suspension, you know, there were 60,000 peaceful fans stuck in that stadium for hours. They ran out of water. They didn't know what was going on. They were tweeting people outside. So it was a quite surreal thing where people were saying, do you know what's happening? And one would go with a WhatsApp from outside. I think it's going to start at 7. But in fact, the hours just went by with no real announcements for them. And that seems quite a shoddy way of organising a massive event, really, regardless of everything else.
Yeah, it really is extraordinary. I guess it remains to be seen if the match will take place and where it takes place. I don't know what country is going to sign up to take that match anytime soon, given what's happened over the weekend. I mean, so it's interesting you make the point about maybe angry young men with not much to do. This still seemed like an extra little layer of madness. To ask a simple but difficult question. Why are Argentinian people so passionate about their football? Like, this was like every bad South American football fan stereotype rolled up into one.
Well, I think, I mean, as I say, 60,000 fans were really well behaved inside the stadium, not to mention millions around the country who were saying things like, this is awful. I mean, there's a beautiful image that went viral of a young man after the game, a River fan, just saying, I just want to apologise to the Boca people. 2 weeks ago, we played in their stadium, and it was a great game, and this is just awful. So I think it's not the whole of the Argentinian nation.
Yeah, fair point.
But there are sociological explanations that have been sought over the years. as to how maybe you construct a national identity. This is a country that is built entirely of immigrants, you know, first, second, third generation, maximum last century. People from all creeds and places come. I mean, it's mostly Spanish and Italian, but it's a real melting pot in social terms. There's enormous social mobility. There's enormous, I don't know, diversity, if you like, in terms of origin. And so it's a relatively new country. A lot of people think that football has been the thing that has given Argentina a sense of national identity more than any other cultural phenomena. So I always remember doing some work for Israeli media about two decades ago. And Israel's also a strange country with a kind of melting pot of people that have arrived to build this nation. And that they were saying to me, when Israel plays any other nation in international football, the crowd is Israeli. Everyone is Israeli, and the visiting country, even if people are from that country, are the opponent. When Argentina come to play for Israel, all the Argentinians who live in Israel become Argentina fans. And I think that's a really interesting observation. I don't know why that is, but I have noticed that Argentinians, even if they've lived abroad for a very long time, such as myself, or if they have incredibly close connections to other nations through direct descendants, or they speak another language at home, you know, it could be Welsh or Syrian. Football is the thing that they really adhere to. And it's a very interesting phenomenon that doesn't explain why the violence, the organized violence that has become related to football has grown so out of control. And I think that has to do with something completely different. I mean, to a large extent, of course, football is still the sport that most helps people out of poverty, gives them hope, gives a sense of belonging and unity in a way that nothing else quite does. But I don't think the incidents that we saw this weekend and the incidents that have taken hold of most of the organized violence in Argentina are related so much anymore to those issues of poverty and sense of belonging. And they have a lot more to do with just the growth of organized criminal activity and the growth of crime in a society that's become very unequal and very difficult for a lot of people to kind of, you know, survive in. And I think crime and football are the way south of the ghetto, if you like, in a superbly oversimplified way. You know, much like boxing and gangsters were, I don't know, in America earlier last century, or... It's just one of those facts. I mean, there's a socio-demographic category that people talk about here called the ni-ni, which means nor, neither nor. And it's young men who neither study nor work. Right. And that kind of unoccupied, mental unoccupied bulk of the population has been growing. Now, it doesn't mean that they necessarily turn to football thuggery.
Sure.
But it does mean that organized systems, whichever they may be, that bring them under their wing, are appealing to them, and they're easy recruits. And I don't think that's specific to Argentina. Sorry, just to add, I mean, I do think we're seeing the same thing in other countries, even countries such as England, where the football-related violence is hailed as an example around the world. We've seen it shift away from the stadiums, but we still have record numbers of young men and gang-related violence on the increase. So, you know, it's a cliche almost, but it does remind me of that conversation allegedly between Margaret Thatcher and the chief of the FA, when she said, "What are you going to do to take your thugs out of our society?" And he said, "With all respect, Prime Minister, what are you going to do to take your really violent people from your society out of my football?" And, you know, in what we saw here this weekend is just a really blatant and brutal exposure of that. So we don't even know if those people throwing stones were were actual River fans or were involved. I mean, some people think it was a plot and an ambush and a political maneuver to make the government look bad. But we do know that what happened was that very thing that has always happened in the crowd, which is somebody starts a small little bit of provocation that grows, and then it just goes off. And then if the police don't respond in a mature and careful and calculated way you have mayhem.
Marcella, you've taken my pretty rubbish question about why Argentinian people like their football so much and created something fantastic. Thanks so much. We're out of time. It's a pleasure having you on as ever.
It's a pleasure to be on, and I really hope that there is a final played sometime, somewhere, that we can enjoy the football and discuss the violence less.
Yes.
Who knows?
No doubt. Well, please come back on and do that if we get one, Marcella. Thanks a million. That's Marcella Mora Iorahu, who, needless to say, is quite brilliant.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.